Well, many thanks to you for being so persistent in getting to these morning sessions. Your tenacity is commendable. We're going to be looking at chapters 2 and 3 of Ruth in this first section, and then chapter 4, and perhaps a more reviewing kind of overview of the book in our second section. Let me read from chapter 3, verses 1 to 9. Ruth, then, chapter 3. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Harry was going to church. He pulled out of his drive in his two-seater sports car, grateful that he had repaired the leak in the hood, for it had been raining heavily since dawn and showed no sign of relenting. As he turned the corner into the main road, he saw ahead of him three figures, huddled forlornly under a single umbrella beside the bus stop. They were all familiar because they all attended Harry's church. The first was old Mrs. Fosdyke. She was well over 70 and suffered great pain from her rheumatism and arthritis that he knew was always worse in damp weather. The second was Dr. Roberts, the local GP. Harry as good as owed this man his life. For a year before, he had diagnosed a rare and dangerous illness that Harry had contracted on holiday in the tropics and had successfully treated it. The third in line was Julia. Harry had entertained a burning passion for Julia ever since she'd come to live in the area, though secretly, for as yet he'd found no opportunity to ask her out. Harry's eye glanced down at the solitary passenger seat beside him. He had only a few seconds to make his decision, but it was enough. With an impressive screech of brakes, he drew up beside the bus stop. Magnanimously, he presented the keys to Dr. Roberts. Attentively, he lowered Mrs. Fosdyke into the passenger seat. And then, with a modest wave, he bid them goodbye, while he huddled close to Julia under the umbrella, praying earnestly that the number 8 bus would be even later than usual this Sunday. Point of my story? Simply this. In matters of romance, meeting the right person almost invariably is the result of a happy collusion between serendipity and science, between good fortune and good sense. Or to use the vocabulary of a Christian theologian, it's the result of a mysterious interaction between divine providence and human responsibility. God put Julia by the bus stop, but Harry had to work out how to get under the umbrella. It will often be so. Indeed, this cooperation between God's sovereign control of events and our personal initiative in exploiting opportunities, that forms the necessary background, not just to a successful love life, but to the life of faith, generally. And there are a few more charming examples of that interplay than this story of Ruth, particularly in its central chapters. Now, if you were here last week, you'll remember that Naomi had returned to Bethlehem in Judah in the wake of a disastrous domestic tragedy. She had lost her husband and both her sons. All she had left was Ruth, her widowed daughter-in-law. Against Naomi's strong advice, Ruth had insisted on coming with her to Judah rather than returning to her own country of Moab. From a human point of view, this was a crazy decision. For a start, Judah was a dangerous place for a woman, especially a single woman from a foreign country, for this was the period before the monarchy in Israel, the period of the judges, when ethnic violence and sexual brutality were commonplace. What's more, Naomi was poverty-stricken. She had no money. The plot of land her husband Elimelech owned in Bethlehem hadn't been worked for 10 years or more. Even assuming they could get it ploughed and sown, which would not be easy without male assistance, it would be at least 6 months before it would provide any income. And in the meanwhile, the only means of livelihood these women would have would be begging of one sort or another. But the toughest aspect of Ruth's decision to stay with Naomi undoubtedly was its implications for her marital prospects. Normally, you see, in the ancient world, it fell to the brother of a deceased man to look after his widow. There was even quite a strong moral obligation laid upon such a brother to marry the widow and have a child by her who could inherit the dead brother's estate. So-called levirate marriage. We shall have more to say about that after the coffee break. But suffice it to say here that Elimelech, Naomi's husband, had no brothers, and all Naomi's own children were dead. This meant there were no close male relatives upon whom the levirate responsibility naturally fell, as far as these two women were concerned. And as a result, their chance of remarrying was negligible. Naomi, it seems, was already too old, and Ruth was a foreigner, without a dowry. There was even a question mark over her fertility, since in 10 years of marriage she had borne Naomi no grandchildren. Always round, then, Ruth and Naomi looked set to share their loneliness indefinitely. It was a bleak outlook, and an insecure one, especially in the violent barbarism that was Israel in that male-dominated 11th century world. Yet the story of Ruth, we know, has a happy ending. Against all the odds, Ruth will find a husband, and Naomi will become a grandmother. Indeed, more startling even than that, the family line thus begun would in due course bring forth a royal dynasty, the dynasty of David, and the dynasty of God's Messiah, Jesus Christ. So this is a classic rags-to-riches romance. This is the story of how Cinderella finds her prince and they live happily ever after. But the thing I want you to notice about these central chapters 2 and 3 is the way that the inspired narrator quite deliberately draws our attention to these two concurrent influences which shape the outcome of his plot. Divine providence on the one hand and human responsibility on the other. God puts Boaz by the bus stop. But Ruth must find a way to put herself under the umbrella. Let's look at the God's providence side of the story, first of all, casting our eyes back to chapter 2, verse 12, where at their first meeting in the cornfield, Boaz says to Ruth, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Right from the beginning of the story, our narrator has been quietly drawing our attention to the all-embracing nature of those providential divine wings that were protecting Ruth. You recall, perhaps, at the end of chapter 1, Naomi's self-pitying complaint at the cruel misfortune that had befallen her. She leaves us in no doubt there that all this misery was down to God. It was His providence that had appointed her sad lot. No less than 4 times in the course of chapter 1, she directly affirms that it is the Lord, the Almighty, who's responsible for all that's gone wrong in her life. Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because the Lord has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune on me. And who can blame her for that sense of betrayal and disappointment? First, the austerity of the famine that drove them to Moab, then the loss of her husband, then the loss of her 2 sons. Such a personal history isn't calculated to engender feelings of gratitude towards God. And yet, of course, as readers of this story, with the benefit of a bird's eye view, and with our eye already on that happy ending that we know must be the final outcome, we know all this had not been a chance chain of events. Ruth the Moabitess would never have come to Bethlehem. She'd have never known the God of Israel. She'd have never played the special part she would play in the family tree of King David and Jesus if it were not for all that misfortune that befell Naomi. Naomi's theology was not at fault. God's providence was indeed supervising the cruel tragedy of her life. But what she felt, at least in the early stages, to be arbitrary strokes of some sadistic heavenly tyrant, were, if only she had known it, necessary preparatory moves in a cosmic plan of salvation, so mind-blowing, so grand in its conception, it would have defeated even the imagination of our sacred author here, I think. You must surely know Cooper's great hymn, "God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense," he says, "but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face." Indeed, if you think about it, God's providential ways in chapter 1 are even more mysterious than Naomi gives him credit for. For the story, remember, begins with what we argued last week any informed Jewish reader would have regarded as a lamentable error of human judgment. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, under the economic pressure of the famine, chooses to emigrate to, of all places, Moab, an enemy nation, an idolatrous nation, a nation about which there were explicit warnings in the law of Moses. No pious Jew would have made such a choice. And yet, extraordinarily, if Elimelech hadn't made that choice, the story of Ruth would never have got beyond chapter 1, verse 1. There's comfort, surely, isn't there, in such observations? Many of us do torture ourselves with vain regrets. "If only I hadn't made that mistake," we say. "I forfeited God's purpose for me by that early act of folly. Now I'm condemned for the rest of my life to have only his second best." Oh, I've heard that so many times from people. But it is nonsense. Where in the Bible is God ever reduced to second best? Where in the Bible does God ever have to resort to contingency plans? Where in the Bible do human mistakes ever obstruct His purpose? Never. On the contrary, the Bible constantly testifies to the way that God, by master strokes of consummate skill, achieves His purposes precisely by means of our human mistakes. What was Judas's betrayal of the Master if it wasn't a mistake? Yet without that mistake, Christ would not have saved the world. So don't allow past mistakes to haunt you. Trust rather
that mistakes though they were, regrettable though they were, God has used them. Maybe they did disappoint him, but you can be sure they didn't surprise him. Maybe those mistakes did hurt or offend him, but you can be sure they didn't thwart him. As in Naomi's experience, maybe the bud did have a bitter taste. But trust him, the flower will be sweet when it blooms. In fact, just follow this story along through the next couple of chapters to see how this divine providence, which had so savagely devastated Naomi's life, was all the time actually working things out, not only for her good, but for the good of Ruth, her daughter-in-law, and for the people of God as a whole. Our author, in fact, drops three gentle hints into his narrative in the early part of chapter 2, designed to sensitize us to this underlying divine directedness in the whole affair. When you read Old Testament narrative, it is the little gentle hints you have to pick up in order to identify the author's purpose. Note, for instance, in verse 1 of chapter 2, he tells us, "Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz." Now, why mention that? Why throw that in at the beginning of verse 1, chapter 2? You could argue that by making that statement there so baldly, our author has robbed himself of a most useful dramatic device by informing us of Boaz's affiliation to Naomi's dead husband at this early stage. If he'd kept that information back, he would have been able to hold us in greater suspense. He'd have been able to generate a much more climactic denouement when the identity of Boaz was finally revealed later on, perhaps in this chapter. But to criticize our author that way fails to recognize his motivation in writing. He is a very skilled storyteller, actually. But he is prepared to reduce, perhaps, the dramatic impact of his narrative if it's necessary for his theological purpose to be achieved. And I think that's what controls his decision here, to give us that bit of information at chapter 2, verse 1. He tells us about Boaz here because he wants us, his readers, to have an insight into the divine providence. A divine providence which Ruth herself, at this point in the story, was necessarily unaware of. You see, in verses 2 and 3, Ruth goes out to glean the loose grains of barley that have fallen in the field behind the harvesters. The poor, you remember, were permitted to do this by law in Israel. There was no question of trespass or theft, though it seems to have been a courtesy to ask permission before you did it. Whose field does she just happen to select for her gleaning activity? The field of Boaz. She doesn't know this man. She's never seen the man. Only we, the reader, have this privileged information about who he was. She has absolutely no idea of his future significance in her life. In fact, the Hebrew of verse 3 draws attention to this most emphatically when it says, "By chance, as it turned out, she found herself working in the field belonging to Boaz." And yet, of course, it was not chance. We know it wasn't chance. Our author has alerted us to Boaz's identity, so we know it isn't chance. We know this is providence at work. And as if to confirm our suspicion in this regard, who shows up at midday to see how things are going? The man himself, verse 4. Just then, or literally the Hebrew says, "Behold," it's an interjection of surprise and wonder. Surprise, surprise, who turns up? Once again, you see, our author wants to alert us to this divine providence that is at work. And so the romance begins. Humanly speaking, a fortuitous encounter. Two pairs of eyes meet for the first time across a harvest field on a summer's day. On the one hand, a penniless widow doing her best to retain her dignity and pay her bills, but forced by circumstance to do the ancient equivalent of rifling dustbins. On the other, a handsome hero considerably older than she, but as our author puts it, a man of standing in the community. And to judge from his pious greeting to the workers on his land, a man of faith too. Well, our imaginations are already racing ahead in anticipation of where this meeting may lead, for it's quite clear God has a hand in it. This is not mere chance. And when Ruth gets home, of course, and tells her story of how this strange man had treated her so nicely, Naomi knew it wasn't chance as well. Verse 19. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "Ah, the Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He hasn't stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead," she added. "And that man is our close relative. He's one of our kinsmen redeemers." So you see, for the very first time since her bereavement, Naomi's faith bursts into new life. God has given her a sign, albeit no larger than a cloud the size of a man's hand at this point in the story, but it is enough to restore her confidence in the trustworthiness of his goodness. Sometimes, of course, under the batterings of circumstance, our faith does ebb so low. We need some kind of evidential sign to reassure it. That is true. Like doubting Thomas, our cherished hopes are so brutally crucified. We must see the print of the nails before we will take the emotional risk of believing again. In Thomas's, as in Naomi's case, God has mercy on such doubts. Not to say that there isn't a better path, of course. "Because you have seen me, have you believed?" said the Master in gentle rebuke. "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." And that was Ruth's blessing. She had seen nothing. She knew nothing. She had no sign. And yet throughout this story, her faith had not collapsed. She'd forsaken the idolatrous culture of her homeland and entered a solemn covenant with Naomi and Naomi's God, in spite of the fact that God had done absolutely nothing really for her up until this point. "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge," prays noble Boaz. Well, indeed, she will, Boaz. And in the sovereign providence of God, you will have a lot more to do with it than you realize right now. Which brings us to the other side of the story I want us to think about: human responsibility. Look on to chapter 3, verse 9 again. "Who are you?" he asks. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Quite a number of recent commentators have drawn attention to the relevance of the story of Ruth to the feminist debate, you know. And it's not difficult to see why. Ruth is quite an audacious lady. She doesn't need a man to tell her what to do. Indeed, contrary to all the cultural expectations of ancient patriarchalist society, she comes pretty close to telling Boaz what to do. This is no shrinking Violet, who is content to simper in the background in the expectation that God will drop his blessings in her lap. No, Ruth is the kind of woman who, insofar as she can, by her own enterprise and energy, work for the fulfillment of God's purpose in her life, she will do so. That's the kind of person she is. We saw the first sign of that individual strength of character last week in her heroic commitment to Naomi. We see it again, I think, in chapter 2, in her diligent application to the task of gleaning. Naomi, it seems, was either too demoralized by her grief or too humiliated by her reduced circumstances to go out and gather corn like a pauper herself. But Ruth suffers no such paralysis. She's not a woman to sit at home and wallow in self-pity or wounded pride. She had trusted God that he still had a future for her. She didn't know what it was. But while she waited for further light on that score, she was determined to make a living for herself and her mother-in-law. And of course, this is the point, isn't it, lying embedded in the story. It is in the very process of doing that, of getting on with the business of living, that God brings to her attention the husband he has in mind for her. God's favor throughout this story is only experienced by men and women as they are active in faith. Nobody finds blessing in this tale by doing nothing. As we've said, at this point in the story, she has no idea of what is to come. No more idea than Boaz does, in fact. She is perhaps just a little flattered by the interest and attention of this older and wealthier man. But there has been nothing in the least flirtatious about Boaz's behavior. On the contrary, his chief concern in chapter 2 was to prevent her suffering any kind of sexual harassment from the workers. His attitude throughout is more that of a benefactor than of a would-be lover. Was he a widower himself? We don't know, it's possible. Certainly, judging from his comment in chapter 3, verse 10, "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." Seems to indicate that he thought he was now so far into midlife that marriage was no longer on the cards for him. There were too many good-looking younger rivals around. Perhaps he felt that to court a bride at his age and in his social position would have seemed undignified, an invitation to humiliation and mockery that a person of his standing in the community shouldn't risk. He certainly entertained no serious anticipation of any romantic liaison between him and this Moabite woman. But he was, nevertheless, attracted to her. That much is obvious. And as our narrator is keen to stress, it wasn't a simple physical attraction either. It was her character that had impressed him. He draws attention to it. Her hard work in the field, he'd noticed it. Her sacrificial commitment to Naomi, everybody had noticed that. And most of all, her faith in the God of Israel, a faith which was all the more obvious in its genuineness because she was a foreigner. Boaz knew, of course, the negative things which the law of Moses said about Moab. But he was a sufficiently spiritual man to realize that it was no part of God's intention by that law to sanctify racism. No, what was wrong with Moab was its idolatry and its hostility to the people of God. When a Moabite woman abandoned that idolatry and that hostility, she was every bit as entitled to seek refuge under the wings of Jehovah as any Jew was. I'm sure there were plenty of others in Bethlehem who would not have looked at things that way. They would have looked at Ruth in a far more xenophobic kind of prejudice. But Boaz, to his credit, did not. Instead, he assured Ruth that she had his personal support. "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she says in verse 13. "You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls." It's not hard, is it, to imagine the brightening of Ruth's eyes as she speaks those words. A man has noticed her. A noble and a good man has treated her with respect, not just as a bit of all right to laugh about with his male friends later on in the day. One wonders if she'd ever been treated that way before. And who could blame her for finding such attention, igniting a little flame of romance in her heart? For as we said last week, Ruth understood covenant love. She understood love that involved commitment and sacrifice. She knew that was the kind of love the God of Israel demonstrated himself and expected his people to demonstrate in their relationships with one another. And here at last, she sensed, In that rather godless Israel of the time of the Judges, she had met a man who shared her convictions and her understanding on that matter. Naomi also agreed. See how Naomi responds at the beginning of chapter 3 again? My daughter-in-law, should I not try to find a home for you where you'll be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Yes, God's providence has pointed the way, but the time for passive waiting is past. An active step of opportunism was now required. Boaz had no idea that Ruth considered him an eligible prospect. How could she let him know? It was going to be far from easy, given the constraints of Oriental sexual protocol. She'd have to select the right place and the right time. But with Naomi's wise counsel to guide her, she chose well. One senses our narrator has his tongue rather firmly in his cheek, as he recounts in the early verses of chapter 3, this conspiracy of feminine wiles. First, the beauty treatment. I think a little splash of Chanel number 5 wouldn't go amiss tonight, my dear, says Naomi. And what about that nice little black number you look so nice in? Then the right moment. Yes, the right moment as well as the beauty treatment. Well, says Naomi, nighttime is so much more romantic than the day, don't you think? And you need to catch him in a nice, relaxed mood. Go down to the threshing floor. But don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying and then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. One does have a suspicion that Naomi was an old hand at this kind of thing, isn't he? There is, of course, considerable debate among the commentators about the significance of that phrase, uncovering the feet. The more modest suggest that the purpose here is simply to wake Boaz gently when he feels his toes are getting cold. But it does have to be said that in the ancient world, the word feet was used in Hebrew as a euphemism sometimes for the genitals. So some commentators do look for an interpretation along that line. At the very least, we have to say this action which Ruth took was decidedly risque. By approaching a man in the pitch dark, she was gambling not just with her dignity, but also with her chastity. If he chose to take sexual advantage of the situation, she would have no defense. What on earth was she doing, uncovering a man at that time of night? Everybody knew what sort of hanky-panky people got up to after the harvest Thanksgiving party. Had she read the nobility of this man's character right? Would he rightly understand her motives? It was all, you see, a huge risk. Our hearts are in our mouths as this situation unfolds in chapter 3. But sometimes life demands such risks, doesn't it? It isn't always enough simply to wait passively on God's providence. Sometimes we have to take responsibility for our destiny. Sometimes we have to exercise our God-given power of self-determination. A courageous, enterprising, opportunistic even, initiative is sometimes required of us, or else we shall forfeit the blessing which God is only too willing to bestow. And Ruth, this woman of character, displays that initiative to the nth degree here. Naomi, you notice, had advised her to keep her mouth shut and let Boaz do all the talking. But rather charmingly, rather delightfully, Ruth is far too irrepressible for such reticence. "Who are you?" he asks. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." This is a case where it really does help to know a little bit of Hebrew, because that phrase, "spread the corner of your garment over me," is deliciously ambiguous.
On the one hand, it's regularly used in Semitic culture as a euphemism for marriage. Spread the corner of your garment over me means marry me. But on the other hand, you see, the Hebrew word for garment or skirt there is actually the same plural word that was used back in chapter 2, verse 12, and translated as wings. Spread your wings on me, invites Ruth. I have absolutely no doubt our author intends a quite deliberate echo of those earlier words of Boaz here. Do you see what Ruth is saying? You prayed for my blessing, Boaz, since I had sought the protective wings of Jehovah. Well now, Boaz, let's face it. You're my dead husband's kinsman, one of the few kinsmen he had. Isn't it up to you to do more than pray for me? Isn't it your responsibility under God's covenant law to redeem me from my helplessness as a widow? Don't you see that as far as I'm concerned, Boaz, you are the answer to your own prayer? The protective wings of Jehovah are your wings. Spread them over me then. Marry me. Yeah, she's an audacious lady, all right. And as we shall see after the coffee break, marry her he does. What do we learn then from this story of Ruth? We learn, I suggest to you, that faith, according to the Bible, is at once passive and active. It's passive in the sense that faith must sometimes be content to wait for God to act. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him, says the psalmist. For it is he, ultimately, who organizes the circumstances of our life. He works out everything, says the apostle, in conformity with the purpose of his own will. Faith means trusting that divine purpose. Trusting that it is a loving purpose, even when we cannot feel the love. Trusting that it is a purpose that can be relied upon to work all things together for our good. We see that faith in Ruth as she accepts her tragic and bereaved situation with good grace, refusing, perhaps unlike Naomi, to let resentment fester in her heart. Faith in this respect is the opposite of fretful anxiety. Faith is patience, it's contentment, it's even resignation. But that does not mean that faith is complacency or idleness or negligence. It's all the difference in the world between trusting in God and twiddling your thumbs. For faith also demands action. Enterprise, endeavor. God appoints means by which we receive his grace, and he expects us to employ those means when we have opportunity. By faith, Abraham left his home, even though he didn't know where he was going, comments the author of Hebrews. And in doing so, of course, Abraham becomes the paradigm of that spirit of adventure which characterizes biblical faith. Faith sometimes requires us to take risks. Calculated risks, it's true. The believer isn't a frivolous daredevil who hazards his or her life in wanton recklessness. Faith assesses the risks it takes. Its audacity is measured and thoughtful. But to the unbeliever, it may sometimes seem as though it is playing Russian roulette with fate, nevertheless. For faith's calculations are based on invisible realities. As again the writer of the Hebrews puts it, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And for that reason, to the unbelieving eye, a step of faith may be indistinguishable from a step of folly. Ruth's audacious words to Boaz here are a classic case in point, you see. What Jewish male could fail to be offended by such a reversal of roles? It was the man who did the proposing, not the woman. Most certainly in those days, even if not now. But such a convention would have left the two of these people locked forever in the tragic irony of their unfulfilled happiness. Ruth had to take the initiative in the relationship.
For Boaz was too self-depreciating even to consider the possibility that a young woman like Ruth might want him. I say again, Ruth is a lesson to us, not only in that passive waiting on God, but also in that active launching out upon God. The tension between the patience of faith and the gamble of faith. I don't know if you're familiar with that anonymous little prayer, which I saw last in a matron's office in a hospital. Give me, good Lord, the grace to perform with diligence those things I can do, to accept with humility those things I cannot do, and the wisdom to distinguish between the two. People become unbalanced in their lives as often as not because they lack that wisdom, don't they? On the one hand, some people tend to become apathetic fatalists, convinced that nothing can possibly make any difference to the way things will work out. Like Omar Khayyam, they resign themselves to fate. Life is just a checkerboard of nights and days, and God deals with men like pawns on that checkerboard. On the other hand, some people become overconfident egoists, sure that they can manufacture their own happiness, boasting like a Henley, in the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. The path of faith lies in neither of those extremes, does it? It understands and reckons on both divine providence and human responsibility. Behind the sometimes mysterious and paradoxical interaction of these two fundamental truths of our existence lies God's desire to make a world over which he is the undeniable sovereign, but in which we also enjoy meaningful freedom. We are not disposable pawns on his chessboard. We are not puppets manipulated by hidden strings. We are voluntary agents, able to make real choices, responsible choices. Yet, contrary to Henley, we're not the masters of our fate either. For our liberty is constrained within the circle of his permission and his loving oversight. Only a God as all-knowing and as almighty as he is could work such a miracle. And it's not surprising if we, with our much more limited understandings and powers, are bewildered about how these two things, our responsibility and his providence, can both be true without the one being sacrificed to the other. But the Bible insists. It is so. He chooses to work his sovereign will by means of our free decisions. And he has built our free decisions, good and bad, into his cosmic plan. Think about prayer. How does it work? God knows what he's going to do. He reads the future with infallible precision. So how can prayer change anything then? It changes things only because God has chosen to work out his will through our prayers. He is determined to involve us in his purposes, and prayer is one of the major ways he achieves that goal. We are not then passive, ignorant pawns, but active and intelligent collaborators with his purpose. Think about our Christian growth in holiness. How does that happen? The Bible says God conforms us to the likeness of his Son. Yet you and I know that that process of moral change does not take place except by our voluntary decision to live in ways that please him. The Holy Spirit is not a spiritual rapist. He waits upon our willingness. Think about the business of gaining our daily bread. Do not worry about your life, Jesus says to his disciples. Look at the birds of the air. God feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? In other words, he says, trust the loving providence of God to meet your material needs. But does that mean that we are to sit with our hands folded and wait for God to put the food in our mouths? Well, if some super spiritual little bird of the air were to take that line, that he was not going to go out to look for worms this morning, he was going to sit in his nest and live by faith, or that pious little fowl would quickly starve to death. For lack of faith, A faith that uses the freedom with which God has endowed it to hunt those worms that he has provided. Think about the issue of guidance. This perhaps most directly from the story of Ruth. Some of us here, I guess, are single, and we would like to find a marital partner. Now, let the story of Ruth teach us that we need to be patient, waiting for God in his providence to put the right person by the bus stop. But that we also, on occasions, need to be decisive, to place ourselves under the umbrella when opportunity presents itself. Don't run away with the idea, with the wrong idea. It's not that God's providence contributes 50% of events, and we are left to make up the other 50%. No, God's providence is at work all the time. He's overruling our clumsy efforts to get under the umbrella, just as he overruled the lateness of the bus. But sometimes his acts in providence leave us with nothing to do, whereas at other times his acts of providence require of us an active initiative, a step of faith. Think about salvation itself in that connection. The Bible says that every saved soul was predestined before the foundations of the world. Yet how does that divine purpose find fulfillment? It finds fulfillment as we actively repent and believe. God does not repent and believe for us. We do it. A decision is required, much though some of us hate that word. Think about the cross. A cross where the Bible tells us the Son of God died in a way that was planned in the eternal counsels of God before the world was made. And yet what do we see in Gethsemane? We see a man. A self-determining man wrestling in prayer and saying, "Not my will, but your will be done." Was the will of God in doubt then? Was Jesus just a pawn in the divine purpose? Was Gethsemane just a huge theatrical? Certainly not. God has so woven the rich tapestry of his purpose together that eternity is contingent on history. The fate of the universe is different because that man, that free man, on that Passover night, chose to grasp the wood of a Roman gibbet, which he could very easily have avoided. "Not my will, but yours be done." He went to that cross, a voluntary sacrifice. It was God's will, but it was also his choice. There above all, perhaps, we see the mysterious way in which the divine providential overruling of events meets human responsibility and intersects. We see how the jigsaw puzzle of human destiny is resolved by these twin forces. Don't be paralyzed, then, by morbid fatalism. But don't be driven either by anxious self-reliance. Live like Ruth, a life of patience and enterprise. In other words, live by faith.